This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine, what are we talking about today?
Okay, Kate. So today we're talking about how we write. So to kick things off, let's start with how things were in the very beginning. When you wrote Skylarking, how did you do it?
I wrote Skylarking in bursts on the train. I wrote it for exercises in class. I wrote it because I had to workshop things in writing workshops. And because of all of that, and because I had no idea that I was writing a novel, it kind of came along that way. I also did National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, for those in the know, which is where you set yourself the task of writing a novel in a month. I think it's 50,000 words you're meant to do in the month of November, and you get this cool little graph to watch your word count rise. I did 30,000. That's what I set myself for. And then at the end of that, it was kind of like, you know, it was a boulder that was rolling down a hill, to use a really, really crappy metaphor. And I felt like I'd come too far to stop the boulder, and I had to keep adding the words.
And did you write from start to finish?
I kind of did, because I had the skeleton of the plot, because it was based on a true story. I was researching a lot as I went, and I left just a lot of highlighted gaps in my text where I had to come back and do the research, because I found the writing really fast and the research quite slow. So I didn't do all the research first and then start the writing, if that makes sense, which some people do.
So fits and bursts.
Fits and bursts.
Flash forward from then to now, what's changed? Has it changed, or are you still riding on the train?
Everything's changed. It hurts now. It's painful.
It's no, like it's going ripping, into a tent and words. Seeing what happens.
It's going into a tent, seeing what happens. One of the things that's really changed is that I've realised that I binge write, which I think is Cheryl Strayed's term, or someone else's term that she's used. And so I write most effectively if I am away from my house and my children and my family and my other obligations. So whenever the opportunity arises, I either go for residencies, which I've done a couple of times, both at Varuna and at Bundanon, or I take myself away. We take ourselves away with our writing group. And in a week, I can kind of get down 30,000 words.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that's what I did at Bundanon. It was crazy. Those words I then had to, they were first words.
Yeah.
So I think the process has got a lot longer for me.
So do you then find that editing has to be done in those binge style sessions, or more the first words have to be done? Or
first words in the binge style sessions. And I've also now done kind of like complete read through and redrafts in those like weeks. Partly, I think the biggest problem I have is holding the whole thing in my head. Like, they're just really messy things, novels. So once I've got something down, then that part, that mathematical kind of moving everything around part, is what I struggle with the most. Those first words I can mostly get down pretty quickly.
Yep.
That's what's changed for me.
Interesting.
What about you? What was your writing process for getting the helpline down?
So the helpline was sort of fits and bursts, but also I suppose I wrote an hour a day for the first probably 3 or 4 of 7 years, say 7 years. That's one of those things that sometimes I say it's 5, sometimes I say it's 10. But
it's all
anyway.
Right. You'll get it down.
depending on how impressive or unimpressive I want to say. but yeah, so an hour a day. And basically the way I did that was I used to exercise before work. So I just got up an hour earlier, exercised, then wrote.
And you were really committed.
Yes.
To that. I remember meeting you and going, whoa, this chick has it together.
Well, it's interesting because Emily Bruin and I, Kate, Emily and I are all in the same writers group, and Emily and I have a lot in common. Our problem is not discipline. Our problem is relaxing and, you know, realizing you sometimes need to back off and just think a little bit rather than, you know, hammer and tongs just sort
well, you,
of get into
you
stuff.
Also both have an extraordinary capacity to get down the words. Like, you get to the end of 2 weeks and you have written every day and you have a body of work that you didn't.
Yes. Yes.
The fortnight earlier. Whereas some of the rest of us, me included, can faff about, not necessarily waiting for the muse, but waiting for all the right things to align to get the words on the page.
Yeah. The flip side is, though, that sometimes you just jam in a, you know, if something's not working, sometimes the answer is not to just keep kind of banging away at it. It's to walk away for a bit and let it rest.
That's really true.
Currently discovering with my second novel.
So how have things changed between the writing of the first and the second?
Well, the good bit about how they've changed is I have a much more structured writing practice now. So when I started doing structural edits and bits and pieces for text, I currently work 3 days a week. I took long service leave 2.5 hours a day. What that meant was my husband and I, basically between us, are one EFT. So on the days that I work, he has the kids and vice versa. So on my work days, I would get up at 5, drive to my parents, write from about 6 a.m. till about 10:30, write or do sort of writing stuff, then go to work from 12 till 5. So do that 3 days a week.
I am sure people will find this totally fascinating because writers find other writers' writing processes entirely fascinating. And I can remember, I think my jaw is doing it again now, just looking at you and going, are you serious? You are so sorted. Like, you are so clearly an engineer.
Yeah, it is. And when I'm finding it difficult, I do the Pomodoro method where I set an alarm for 25 minutes, write hardcore, 5 minutes break, just cycle through it. So very structured in that sense. And that was great for the re-editing process of The Helpline. But this second novel feels, I'm finding that much harder. And I think it's just that I need to have a break from it. So I ran out of long service leave pretty much around the time The Helpline was finished, but some of the international rights stuff has theoretically meant that I can drop a day a week and so basically keep those 3 solid writing sessions.
Which is really important.
It's great. But I was going to say before, but just not sure I was out of frame things. One of the beauties of getting published is the validity that, you know, it validates something, you know.
Absolutely. So that you
feel
now know,
okay to cut back a bit.
Or to put your kids in childcare or to have them be minded by someone else, which is how I manage mine.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
I am writing. Whereas I know that for many people, there's a moment there where they're like, no, this has to be my secret additional, you know, treat it as a, they'd have to treat it as a hobby because they don't feel validated in taking that time. And that's a really hard place for people to be.
Absolutely. In terms of best writing scenarios, the morning is definitely the best for me and I'm only really good for about 4 hours. I wouldn't say I'm employee of the month when I go to work having done my writing session. But I think we should touch on the writer's retreats that we do.
Absolutely.
So we have 7 women in our writer's group and we go away twice a year. We generally book a place about 1.5 hours from Melbourne. We do one retreat that's about a week. And then one that's probably, what, a Thursday to a Sunday?
Yep.
Do you want to talk?
Well, the key thing is that we have Varuna rules.
That's what I was about to say.
Yeah. So a couple of you and I have both been to Varuna. A couple of us have. And that idea that between the hours of 9 and 6, we don't answer phones. Really easy in that particular house because there's no friggin' reception, which is helpful. So we don't answer phones. We don't talk to each other unless there's a really clear invitation to speak, like around the kitchen table or that people are kind of lolling about on the floor outside your room making moaning noises, in which case you might go out and say, are you okay? We all bring our own writing books and we kind of chuck them all in the middle so that there's always that exchange of ideas and it's drinks at, you know,
6:01.
6:01 gets to about 5 in your room by the end of the week. But it's an extraordinarily productive time. There's time to do the chatting at night. We don't necessarily share any of our work.
I think I've only been there when we've done that once.
Yeah. And I think that's the same that happens at Varuna. Some groups do, some groups don't. But as we were leaving last time, I remember saying to Meg, who's one of the other women in our group, just nip back into your room and just kind of like even suck in the air of it, the smell of it, the feel of it, because it's a shortcut. And I think that's what people who have studios and that kind of thing must have, that when we are there, I just feel this enormous shortcut into getting into the creative space. I feel alive with the words. I feel like I can get an enormous amount done. I normally absolutely fall in a heap after the week, but it has become a shortcut to a really effective creative process.
And it's fun.
And it's fun. And it's fun too.
In this episode, I speak to writer, editor, and literary agent Danielle Binks about YA in Australia, the problems with excluding genre, and what it feels like to have her name on the front of a book, not just in the acknowledgements. T, Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Danielle Binks to The First Time. Danielle Binks is an editor, book blogger, literary agent, and youth literature advocate. In 2017, she edited and contributed to Begin, End, Begin, a hashtag Love Oz YA anthology of new Australian young adult writing, inspired by the hashtag Love Oz YA movement and released by HarperCollins. Danielle is an agent with Jacinta DeMase Management, seeking authors of young adult and middle grade fiction works. Welcome, Danielle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we're going to get straight into it. Writer, editor, agent. You're the triple threat. How did you start out in the literary world?
Well, I was always a reader. That much is true. And once I was in year 12 at high school, I looked around and kind of thought, what job could I do that's writing? And the only thing I could think of, and that clearly my counsellors as well, could guidance counsellors could think of, was like journalism. Even though I hadn't shown much interest before, they were like, you should be a journalist. You want to write for a living. They were clearly worried about my, you know, bottom line and hip pocket. So they were like, maybe you can make something out of journalism.
It would be an unusual guidance counsellor that suggested you become an author.
Exactly. Yeah. Really weird. So I applied to Monash University, did a communications degree over 3 years with a like major in journalism. And I remember sitting in my very first lecture and thinking, this isn't for me. I shouldn't be here. I don't know. It was just, to me, it was all the guys in the journalism course wanted to be sports writers and commentators, and all the girls wanted to write for Cosmo and Cleo and Dolly and Girlfriend and stuff. And I was just sitting there thinking, none of this appeals to me. But I did it. I stuck it out for 3 years because I'm not a quitter, though I should have been. I just kind of said, no, I want that debt. Give me that 3 year debt. And I constantly got told by my teachers and lecturers, your prose is way too flowery. You know, who, what, when, where, why. That's it. None of this purple prose stuff. None of this backstory. So I kind of had the inkling then. And then in my last year of communications, we did a media component where we had to sort of choose a stream of publishing media in Australia. And I chose actual books publishing. And I did an internship for 1 month with what was then Black Dog Books, which is now an imprint of Walker Books, which had a big young adult youth literature component. So I worked with them for a month, and that was when I sort of got to see behind the curtain and I saw, oh, wait, there's an entire industry of books and books for young adults and kids. Like there's editors, there's cover designers, there's typesetters, there's publicists. What is this? So I got to the end of communications, had done this internship, and then realized there's this whole other world of writing, which is actually writing in books. So I went the long way round, as the Dixie Chicks would say. I went the long way round. I finished communications and then decided to go off. And the course that constantly got recommended to me was RMIT Writing and Editing. And I was constantly told by various people who I inquired about it with that it was a really hard course to get into. They had a lot of applicants and they took on less than half of them. And at this time as well, I wasn't really writing. I was writing fan fiction all throughout.
But that is writing.
That's right. I mean, from like the middle of high school and throughout all of uni, because I was so depressed in uni writing journalistic, boring entries.
A big part of journalism is that investigative. Some people love that component.
And I just, unless I could do a whole backstory about who I was talking to, unless I could spend, you know, 3 weeks with somebody getting their whole story out of them, as opposed to picking apart possibly the worst moment of their life, I just wasn't interested. But I was constantly running fan fiction. I had always been a lurker of fan fiction sites. Ever since Buffy the Vampire Slayer came out, I had just been lurking on fan fiction websites and, you know, discussion groups, and I started writing it myself.
In Buffy?
In Buffy, or in the West Wing, in a show called Once and Again, in Veronica Mars, in Dawson's Creek, in...
Did you say the West Wing?
The West Wing. Yeah.
Right. I always associated fan fiction with fantasy.
No, it's everything. It's everything. And Once and Again as well is like this really straight contemporary TV show about two blended families coming together. Like it was really narrow stuff, and I loved it. But when it came time to apply for RMIT, as you would know, you have to submit a piece of writing. And I didn't have any of my own writing. I had stuff that I'd written in year 12 for creative writing components, and I had my fan fiction. So I submitted a Buffy the Vampire Slayer one-shot piece of fan fiction. I got called into an interview, and I will never forget, I had to sit in front of Penny Johnson, who is an amazing editor at RMIT
She's
and teacher.
Lovely too.
And I had to explain to her what fan fiction was and what Buffy the Vampire Slayer was.
Right, okay.
And then she sort of said, well, that's really interesting. And I thought, I'm done. I'm cooked. That was terrible. I'm out of here. But they agreed to have me. And I did 2 years of RMIT writing and editing.
And you actually managed, you were one of the few people that actually managed to do it in 2 years.
In 2 years, because I had already done 3 years previously at Monash, which I thought was like a huge, you know, time waste that I'd committed to. But actually, if I look back on it now, I learn a lot about writing from writing journalism. Like, there is benefit to learning how to write scarce, you know, to get to the point. I mean, I'll never forget one of my lecturers said, if you take anything out of the Bible, take this, Jesus wept. Two words, gets it done, in and out. You know, you don't have to do rivers of tears from Danny's cheek. No, Jesus wept. And I've always stuck with that. And maybe I had to do 3 years of Monash to get Jesus wept out of the entire degree.
That's like, what, 20 grand a word or something?
Yeah,
roughly.
But worth it, I say cynically. But yeah, I did RMIT writing and editing, and I did it assuming that I would be a publicist or an editor and I wouldn't be a writer. And then we had to do, you can't really get out of doing RMIT without writing. You've got to be a writer so that you can give your stuff to other people to edit and vice versa. So they get writing out of you some way. I remember I had to write a short story in an editing class so that it could be edited by a fellow classmate. And there was a theme you had to write to. So I wrote this short story and I was really quite proud of it. And then it just so happened that VoiceWorks magazine, the theme kind of fit with what our theme was too. And I love the short story so much, I didn't just want it to be a class assignment. So I submitted it to VoiceWorks and it got in. And it was the first place that any of my writing had ever been published. And as you probably know, it's a little bit of an adrenaline hit
moment
to see your name in print and to get editorial feedback and to be told, oh, this is quite good. Felt really good. I slowly moved away from writing fan fiction and started delving in my own fiction. And that one chapter of my life doesn't even bring us up to, I guess, because during all this time as well, I was also book blogging, which is the other thing. I started book blogging in 2009, the same year that I started at RMIT. And the two weren't mutually exclusive. I started a book blog because I had, again, been a big lurker on other people's book blogs, reading reviews, getting reading recommendations. When I got to the end of Monash, I really thought that I wouldn't get into RMIT. And I thought I have to connect with books in some other way as an outlet for me. Fan fiction was one outlet. Books that I'd rediscovered was another. And I thought book blogging could be my outlet if I didn't get into RMIT. Turned out I did get in. And then the book blog became a really nice kind of harmony to what I was learning about books and writing. I was then putting into the reviews I was writing as well. So I also credit RMIT with that because the right people read my book blog and were interested in the stuff I was saying around young adult literature in particular. And then it was Kill Your Darlings came knocking on my door saying, do you want to be an online commentator for us writing about youth literature? And I said, yes, I'd love to. So from 2012 onwards, I wrote a whole lot of stuff for Kill Your Darlings. And then I think it was around 2015 or 2016 where I was sitting at the Wheeler Center waiting for my writing group to start. And I got tapped on the shoulder and it was Jacinta. And she said, I recognize you by your hair and I read your stuff that you write on social media and Kill Your Darlings and I really like it. Let's get in touch. And the rest, as I say, is history.
So this is Jacinta Demase of Jacinta Demase Management.
Yes. I had no idea who she was. When she said that she was a literary agent, I instantly started, my brain started wheeling and dealing and thinking, you mean my fiction writing? You mean my, but no, she wanted me to be an agent. Because I think in my Kill Your Darlings writing, I had been so, I was a little bit critical of the state of YA in Australia. And I very much, I think, had this undertone of stuff needs to change. Something needs to happen. Something needs to break, you know? And she kind of said to me, if you want to really make a difference, come on board and be an agent.
I'm interested to talk to you about some of the YA stuff. But first, let's talk about your first time. So you edited and contributed, in the way that you wear multiple hats, to the Love Oz YA anthology. Can you tell us how that came about?
Again, I don't tell. This is, you're getting a little bit of why my journalism lecturers didn't really like me. I have long stories. Nothing is simple. Nothing is Jesus wept. Okay. So buckle in. It's another long story. It was 2014 and 2015. The Australian Library Information Association started releasing lists of the top 10 most borrowed books in Australia from libraries across, not school libraries, but local libraries across the country. And there were four categories, adult fiction, adult nonfiction, children's and YA. And in three of those categories, it was an even split of the most borrowed books were by international authors and Australian authors, except in the YA category. In the YA category, there were only two Australian authors represented. It was Marcus Susak's The Book Thief and Ali Mani's Every Breath, first book in a crime trilogy. The rest were all, as you would expect, around that time, 2014, 2015, it was all big blockbuster YA adaptations. A lot of John Green.
Fault in Our Star.
A lot of John Green, a lot of Cassandra Clare, a lot of Maze Runner, Veronica Roth, Divergent series. we clearly saw, our little community of readers and writers clearly saw that we were being overrun and overtaken by the sort of monolith US publishing industry. So we kind of banded together and said, this sucks. Let's try and sort of raise our collective voices up and just uplift Australian YA and why it's so important that we have a national youth literature. We can't let it slip away, you know, just because it gets a little bit harder to shout above the cacophony of a big blockbuster.
So how did you, because community is a really big thing for you. How did, you were already connected with that community? Is that?
Yeah, I was already connected with the community.
How?
What connected me, I think, was Kill Your Darlings.
Yep.
Was they took, and I will say I met, to backtrack again, I scored my first publishing job as a publicist through the Australian Publishers Association, had a paid internship program. And a year after I graduated, very rare, doesn't happen anymore. It's no longer running as far as I know. A year after I graduated at MIT, I was still looking around for a job and I couldn't find anything. I was still working in my old high school job at the local post office. Couldn't get anything, was applying to government roles, local councils, anything that I could put copywriting and publicity and stuff too. But I really wanted to work in books. And then this internship came along. And it is very rare in publishing to get a paid internship for 6 months. And it was something like six different publishers from all over Australia were looking to be part of this program, bringing on interns. And I got picked up by Spinifex Press, which is the sort of last indie feminist publishing house in Australia. And I got the paid internship with them for 6 months. And then once that ended, they offered me a job, a part-time job as publicist. So I took that up. And at one point they had somebody called Imogen Candell come in as an intern. And she was a great intern for about 6 months. She was awesome. Was not surprised that she then went on to become the digital online editor of Kill Your Darlings. And it turned out that because we'd shared an office when she was an intern and I was a publicist, I had talked her ear off about YA literature. And I had recommended it to her and we had sparred a little bit about why she didn't read it, what she thought of it. And I was constantly pushing against her and giving her reading recommendations and saying, no, YA is really, it's amazing, you got to read it, it's very literary, it's doing things that are interesting.
Because you have also spoken about YA not being a genre,
bugs me. This is one of my very first Kill Your Darlings pieces, was YA is a readership made up of any number of genres. There is even Amish teen romance, if you want to get real niche about it. What annoys me about saying it's a genre is it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what it is and who it is for. And it also makes it easier for people to disregard it if they think it's a genre. Because it's fair enough if you're someone who just doesn't like historical romance. Fair enough. But when you say that you don't like the YA genre, you are eclipsing so many variants and so many gorgeous, different voices. You're just wiping it all aside and saying, I don't like anything that's for teens. And it's like, hold on. If you like magical realism, you know, go and read some Kelly Link, go and read some Margot Lanigan, see what you think. Don't just sweep aside an entire readership that is for teenagers that is giving them a voice and a platform just because you perceive it to be one thing.
So that's how you see it, that it is a voice and a platform?
Yes. I think it is. Okay, so young adult, the term, was coined for a marketing reason with S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders, which was first published in 1967. Do like a fact check on that, but I'm pretty sure 1967. And it wasn't published originally as young adult fiction. It was just fiction. It was a dime store paperback written by S.C. Hinton when she was 16, to be fair, published when she was about 17. Like, it was impressive. And she was writing about teenagers too, but they still marketed it as they had everything else, dime store paperback, adult fiction. And it didn't do anything. It didn't blip. Nothing really happened with it. Few months in, though, they started to see like a spike in sales. And they traced it back to teachers and librarians and schools were buying it and reading it to kids who were then going off and buying their own copies. And suddenly there was this groundswell of it was a teenager writing about teenagers. Ultimately, it turned out for teenagers. And the term young adult was coined. That makes it sound like, though, that only America had teenagers and they didn't. Obviously, there'd been a lot of fiction beforehand that is now retroactively called YA. Catcher in the Rye, for instance, is now sort of seen to be one of the first YA books, Lord of the Flies, etc. But with S.C. Hinton's The Outsiders, that was when marketing came into it and said, we're going to market this to teenagers for teenagers. Interesting, in 1967 was also the release of Picnic at Hanging Rock in Australia. So it's a fallacy to think that America was making these great strides in youth literature and we weren't doing anything over here. Because I would say that Picnic at Hanging Rock could be categorized very loosely nowadays as YA as well. The next time that YA had the big transformation was the release of Harry Potter, the first Harry Potter book, in 1997, I believe.
That Harry Potter first That's YA.
Well, I would say that the series begins as junior fiction, goes into middle grade, and then around Goblet of Fire is when it transitions into YA. It's... And I personally think it's the death of Cedric Diggory. Spoiler alert, if you haven't read that book, it's been out for decades.
Too late now.
I think the death of Cedric Diggory that Harry takes on as his fault is a very dark twist in the story, and that's where it becomes YA. But it often gets called a YA series because the latter books are. It is one of the few examples you can point to, though, of the series ages with the characters and readers. Very deliberately, it ages with the characters and readers, but it's not until Goblet of Fire, I personally think, that is when it becomes YA. But that was when YA as a whole was transformed, because it suddenly went from, and I always do this, when I do school talks, I tell kids about the history of YA. And when I get to this point, I say to them, put your hands up if you've read The Outsiders. And I probably get like a few scraggly hands. Yeah, I had to read it for school, I had to read it for class. When I say, put your hand up if you've read one of the Harry Potter books, every hand goes up. And I always say to them, that is the difference between inventing YA and reinventing YA. Like, it went huge.
Mm.
Everyone was reading YA. Everyone was reading this series for kids, even adults were reading it. And it just blew up. It became a huge enterprise. It became big bucks money. That was the turning point for YA.
And do you think that fan fiction and YA, is there a link between those things or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, because fan fiction traces back to Star Trek days.
Okay.
That was when the first lots of fan fiction came out, were people who loved Star Trek so much that they wanted to take little pieces of it for themselves. And they would actually put out like zines and stuff of their fan fiction writing without knowing it was fan fiction writing. That was sort of where it traces back to. But certainly fan fiction again exploited with the Harry Potter stories. And I don't know, it was probably because Harry Potter can be traced along the lines of the digital age becoming a huge thing. And suddenly what also made Harry Potter so big was it connected fans from all over the world, which is one of the beautiful things about Harry Potter, isn't it? Like, Dumbledore's army is real. It exists. It's beautiful. Kids have learned from those books. They've, you know, developed empathy from those books. It's been, studies have been proven. And I think what was huge about it was that the Harry Potter books released at the same time as kids were discovering each other online. So suddenly these huge communities built around Harry Potter, talking about Harry Potter. And the movies came out and it was just bigger and bigger and bigger. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a correlation more between fan fiction and Harry Potter and the digital age, probably, which is kind of magic in itself.
Mm.
It's a little bit of magic.
All right, let's go back to the anthology.
Oh God, I'm rattling on.
After a brief detour.
No, okay, so Alia. So terrible results came out that basically said Australian teenagers were not reading Australian YA. We have a lovely national youth literature here, which is really special. Not every country in the world has a national youth literature in a really big way. It's probably Australia, the UK, US, Canada, and Germany. Also really big for some reason.
There seem to be a lot of links between Australia and Germany.
Really weirdly, books. Right?
Yeah.
Kind of beautiful. My family's Austrian background, and I actually have an aunt who's a German teacher in high school. So it's really interesting when she comes back from doing German trips, she'll bring like YA books that have been adapted, because they Germany buys a lot of Australian YA, you know, internationally. It's just really fascinating to me. And like German TV shows, Swedish TV shows, Nordic television is also really teen orientated and geared. It's really fascinating. They've seemed to have recognised that if you want to grow this sort of cultural industry, you got to start with the next generation who are going to be asked to consume it, right? So you have to appeal to them, which makes sense. So anyway, the Love Oz YA hashtag was born out of bad news. It was bad news that Aussie teenagers were not reading Australian stories. And it wasn't just Alia that was reflecting this. It was also book sales. Book sales of Australian YA fiction are still slumping, are still not great. But sales of stuff like John Green and Rainbow Rowell and Cassandra Clare, through the roof. Sarah J. Maas, through the roof. We clearly had to do something. And our response, I think, that was really gorgeous was love. We said, we just want to talk about how much we love when we can see ourselves reflected on the page and what it means to tell our own stories. Not because we want to block out other voices. This isn't about patriotism or xenophobia. It is about making sure that we have a voice on that stage as well. Harper approached me in 2016, maybe 2015, end of 2015, 2016, and said, we have this idea that a publicist there called Manda Diaz came up with. She said, let's put an anthology together of short stories, some of our favourite YA authors. And I'm thankful every day that they looked around and kind of said, what about Danielle?
That's amazing. So Jacinta approached you, Harper. That's a really nice, you've carved out a nice.
Yeah. And again, I credit it with the Kill Your Darlings. I credit it with Imogen Candell, who I, when she was an intern and I was a publicist, I talked her ear off about YA. And then when she was in a position.
Ultimately a credit to yourself, though.
Well, obviously like, I'm mouthy. You know. Can you tell? I'm mouthy. When she was in a position to do something about it, when she became online editor of Kill Your Darlings, she reached out to me and said, look,
great.
There's a blind spot for Kill Your Darlings. We don't talk about YA literature a lot. What do you want to come on and write about? And they gave me free rein for my first piece, which is like a bit of an audition piece. And I wrote about, in 2012, I put together an article about why we need more Indigenous voices and creators in YA. And I got to interview Sue McPherson, Amblin Quaymalena, and Vicky Wakefield. Vicky Wakefield being a white author who frequently writes Indigenous secondary characters. I read back through everything that I wrote for Kill Your Darlings and I'm proud of all of it. And I stand by all of it. And that one in particular, if you think that the hashtag we need diverse books and own voices conversation happened through the US in like 2014. And I was writing that in 2012 because Sue McPherson and Anne Boleyn put out these amazing books that made me stop and think, why haven't I read more Indigenous characters, teen characters in my YA? Why has it mostly been this white, cis, heteronormative narrative, middle-class Australia? And we had a discussion in this piece I wrote about, you know, who gets to tell Indigenous stories? Why don't we have more characters on the page? And Vicky Wakefield came in as a person, as a white writer, like I said, writing secondary Indigenous characters, who said to her, if she just wrote other white characters populating her universes, that's not Australia to her. And Sue McPherson agreed with her and said, to not write us would be a whitewashing in itself. We're not asking you to write first-person narratives about us. We are asking you to include us and do the work when you do represent us.
So there's a lot of debate happening at the moment about diversity and what people writing what you know and all that sort of stuff. What's your take on?
So I can't deny that I came in to the literary agency side of things with an agenda. And if I'm being really honest, it was a feminist agenda and it was an agenda for more diversity and inclusivity. And I say that as somebody who has to check my own privilege because I am white woman, but I came in having written all these pieces for Kill Your Darlings, having really, I love the Australian YA industry, but I recognize that it has blind spots and faults. And I wanted to reverse a few of those. I wanted to be a part of a change that is happening in publishing to make things better and more diverse. Because what it comes down to is we read to know that we are not alone. And that's the whole reason that we read books. We read to know that we are not alone.
Yeah.
And any teenager out there who has never read their life on the page, or seen themselves on the screen, or even just in adverts on TV, any teenager who has just sat there and said, I'm not represented anywhere, I can't go on. I cannot stand for that. So I'm trying to bring a little bit of that into what I do as an agent, especially. So
in terms of the anthology, was the process to say to sort of a community contribute stories, or you were much more structured about the approach that you took?
We were actually really structured. It was HarperCollins and Tran Bing, who is our publisher at HarperCollins. We sat down and we came up with a list of authors we would love to include. And then we did lists separately. And then we came together and said, where are the crossovers? Who do we both have on our lists? And we approached people who said they couldn't do it because of time constraints and deadlines needing to be met and, you know, all these reasons. But the people that we did get are amazing and they were all on our list as well. But Trent and I did come out and say we wanted it to be a diverse collection, and it's not a perfectly diverse collection by any means, but we wanted it to be a snapshot of Australia, and that to both of us was diversity in the creators and content. Like I said, though, I know it's not a perfect collection for that reason. We, you know, there were people who we would have loved to have been in it, who would have made it an absolute kaleidoscope, but for various reasons, and I would love to one day approach them and say, let's do a second volume and let's try with those people again. But yeah, very much we want it to be a snapshot of Australia, but also a true snapshot of what it is for us to write our own stories. Because I think there is this assumption that in Australia, in our literature in particular, Australia thinks of itself, I think, as contemporary stories set on coastal towns or in the bush. It's this kind of Tim Winton-esque.
I was actually just thinking,
you know,
of Tim
that's
Winton.
What we think of when we think of our national literature, and it's not true. Mm. Like, we've had Garth Nix since the early 90s paving the way for young adult fantasy. We have Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff, two of our most famous young adult exports, writing space and horror, amazing adult and young adult series, basically. We have Margot Lanigan, who has always straddled the genre line of magical realism and stark reality and mythology. But we have this assumption that we're all Tim Winton, and we're not. You know, Tim Winton doesn't represent me necessarily in his books. As much as I love Cloud Street, I do read his stuff and think that's not all of Australia. But it's what also is populating reading lists in schools. So kids get into their head that worthy Australian literature that they read when they're in high school for VCE or whatever the equivalent is in other states and territories. Mm. That's what Australia is. And it's often like a small outback town or a quaint coastal village, contemporary, gritty, and it's not always us. So we also wanted to put out a whole lot of different genres into the anthology. So there is romance in there. There is intergalactic battles. There is horror in there. There is time travel in there. And there are also contemporary stories in there because that's us too. But we wanted to sort of niggle at this idea that Australian stories are one note because we're not.
And so what was the process of editing like? Yeah. Did you have to edit people pretty hard or did it vary?
No. So Jacqueline Moriarty, for instance, comes in with her short story and it's like, maybe put a comma in there. She's very good. Well, you know, we're editing the likes of Will Kasakis, Amy Kaufman, Michael Pryor, Melissa Keel, Gabby Tozer, Ellie Marnie. These people are very good at what they do. They've been writing for a little while now and they've got sharp minds and sharp storytelling skills. So there wasn't a whole lot of editorial involved. There was a little bit of poking questions and asking, you know, but I'm not going to overly edit Alice Pong, for instance. She's pretty damn good. And again, when she submitted the story, I kind of said to her, oh, maybe it needs an extra the in that sentence, maybe. I don't know. Most of the editorial, I swear, most of the stress came from how do we arrange the stories.
Right.
Because Trent said it's like putting together a really great mixtape. You want long stories and short stories side by side so people have a little bit of a rest in between. You want different genres side by side, you know, so that was the harder part. But no, these contributors are at the top of their game. They were very easy to edit. I do not know what it was like to edit me, though.
Yeah. Well, how did you decide what you wanted to contribute?
So having said that Australian stories are not contemporary, set in small towns, that's what I wrote. I wrote a contemporary story set in a small town about a group of teenagers spending their last night together before they all go off into different corners of the world after school ends. I had the benefit, though, of a bird's eye view. So I knew that Will Kasakis, who normally writes contemporary, was actually going to write a story about a kid who has telepathy. You know, I knew that Jacqueline Moriarty was going to write a time travel story. I knew that Amy was going to do, you know, intergalactic space. So I had the benefit of being able to step back and say, actually, what's really funny is,
even though
we were writing this, putting this together to show that we're not one thing, I want to write to that sort of lodestone home of YA storytelling in this country, which is kind of small town, friendships focused.
Australia has always had a fascination with the kind of the outback, smaller towns, those.
Yeah.
Even
I think
for a largely city dwelling population.
I think it kind of goes back to the mythology we have around literature. If you think about like the picnic at Hanging Rocks, is this push-pull of colonialism and the bush. It's this really beautiful distillation of these two things warring against each other. And it's actually about colonialism coming into what was an established old land, and the land kind of takes back a little bit, you know, takes a big chunk out of those girls. And also it's like the Ned Kellys being part of our mythology. It's all of that kind of stuff.
That very bush-based,
you know, the Banjo Pattersons, the Man from Snowy River kind of stuff. Those are our kind of modern storytelling lodestones. I think Australia's very hung up on not having classic literature, which is another thing. There's sort of this cultural cringe where we look at the US and UK and these authors who we constantly study in school, and we give them to our kids to study in school. We say the Oscar Wildes, we say the John Steinbecks, read them, they're amazing, the great novelists, the Charles Dickens, all of them. And we kind of say we don't have that in Australia. Ours is a lot earlier, so it feels like it's lesser than, and it's not. It's this thing of, this is kind of what the Stella Prize Schools program as well talks about, which is another fantastic organization. Stella Prize Schools pokes holes in this idea of classic was always white male, because that's who was allowed to publish for a long time, right? So the idea that we attribute classics to better literature is fundamentally flawed, because for so long it was only white men allowed to write, you know? So, I find that all really interesting, and it's interesting how we interpret that as Australians, where we still think that the US and UK is where good literature is at. That's where the classics are. That's what we try and aspire to be, you know. So we've got to poke holes in that a little bit more, I think.
So what were the highlights for you in creating the anthology?
Oh, man. Getting to approach every single author and ask them to be part of it.
So you got to do that yourself?
I got to do that, yeah.
So how did you get people's email addresses and, like, logistically, how did that even happen?
I'm really lucky in that I actually know a lot of them.
Yeah.
We've become friends. We become friendly on social media. I've read all of them before and written reviews of them. Will Kasakis, someone who I've just loved forever. Amy as well. Alice, Jacqueline, Melissa Keel, Ali Mann, like, Gabby, all of them. I've read their stuff and I love their stuff. And when I approached them, it wasn't as though they were sort of saying, oh, who are you again?
Yeah.
I was lucky in that through my blogging and through my writing for Kill Your Darlings again and my social media stuff, they knew who I was and that they also knew that something was stirring in Love Oz YA. So when I came to them and said, we're going to put an anthology together, they were already up on the Love Oz YA movement. They knew what it was about. They loved the idea of a celebration in this anthology. It was a really easy sell. And truly, nobody outright said no to me who couldn't be part of it. They all said, I want to do it so badly, but I've got deadlines. I'm finishing up this manuscript. I've got commitments to publicity. Everyone kind of said, come back to me if you do another one.
So you wanted to get it out pretty quick to keep the momentum.
Definitely. I mean, I'm really pleased that it's still going. Love Oz YA is still, you know, there's a committee attached to it now, which I was also really proud to be part of the first committee of Love Oz YA, this grassroots movement. It's become part of our lexicon now, a shorthand for I love the literature of our nation, of our, you know, the national youth literature. So I'm really happy with that. But there was definitely this feeling of let's get it out. Let's do this. Let's keep riding this wave.
And were you always going to include the hashtag in the title?
I don't think so. And I'm in two minds about whether or not that worked. Because on the one hand, if people remember that it's a hashtag, it's really searchable and easy to find. But on the other hand, I wonder if it's going to date the hashtag thing, you know? So I don't know. I'm in two minds about it. Maybe it's a little bit clunky, but at the same time, it's made searchability a little bit easier. Mm. And the whole idea was somebody sees the hashtag and knows that's a searchable term to go off and look at what that is. And I still think that hashtags like We Need Diverse Books are still going strong. So maybe it will hold up, but I'm in two minds. I don't know.
And what sorts of things were you prepared for and what were you not prepared for?
In the editorial process or post-publication
In having a book that has your name on it.
Like I said, from the time that I was first published in VoiceWorks to now, it never gets old, the adrenaline rush of seeing your name in print. I wasn't prepared for how proud I would be being amongst those contributors. Like, this is my first published fiction piece. And I was alongside people who I've long admired, who are at the top of their game, like I said, who are multiple times published authors. And then there's me, the newbie. So when I was writing my short story, I had imposter syndrome, thinking this isn't going to be any good. Mine's going to stick out like a sore thumb. I'm the one that they got all along. You know, I was really worried about that. And then once the story came out, I really just decided to own it. And be like, I'm proud of this.
It is a wonderful story.
Oh, thank you.
I enjoyed it a lot.
A little bit of me. It's a little bit of everything that I love about YA. It's siblings. It's friendship stories. It's, like I said, small towns. They do exist and I am fascinated by them. There's some diversity in there as well. But something that surprised me post-publication that I should have been aware of, but I'm continually surprised by it, is how many people, teenagers, come up to me and say, I love this story, and this story, but not these ones. And it's never the same. There's no one story that people continually love above all others. It's such a mixture. There are kids who love the sci-fi stories and then kids who love the contemporary stories. And that's what we wanted. We wanted to be a smorgasbord. And then some kids have come up to me and said, I do not read sci-fi, but I read Amy's or I read Will's or I read Michael's and I want to go off and read a little bit more. Like, it was just enough of a teaser, of a taster for them to go off and explore. That's what we wanted as well. But I'm constantly fascinated at what favorite stories they have, because it's never the same combination.
I do love that about an anthology, though, because you go in with the expectation, some I'm going to love, some I'm not going to love. Yeah. That's an exciting process of discovery.
It fascinates me, you know, the different combos of favorite stories. And I love that. I love hearing people's favorites, even if it's not mine.
And I won't ask you what your favorites and least favorites are. Talk to me about winning the Arbias.
Yeah, that was really cool.
So you were saying before the interview that it's one of the few awards that you don't find out.
We do not find out. I mean, Harper flew me out to Sydney for it and I thought, oh, is this a hint? And I kept asking my editor, you know, have you been told? And she said, no. But they flew out like pretty much all of their authors who were nominated because they really can't tell who's won and who hasn't, because it's one of the few awards where they don't make sure that the winners are going to be present to accept. So I went along and I just thought, I'm going to get a free meal out of it. I've seen Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales. I've seen Julie Gillard in the distance. I'm good. If I don't win, I'm good. I've had a good time. I got a photo with Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales.
Oh, my God. Two of my favorite.
I got to say to Lee Sales, you're so tall. And I got to say to Annabelle Crabb, I love your hair, because we're both curly girls. And I was like, I'm done. I'm spent. Awesome. I got a lovely steak dinner.
Oh, you got the steak, not the fish?
Yeah, I went with the steak, not the fish. And I thought, I'm done. And then our award category came up. And the other thing is, you see other authors who are also shortlisted and you think, oh, they must have it there. Like, because we were flown in from all different parts of Australia. We were all pretty much from different states and territories. And I thought, okay, you know, someone else is here who's on the shortlist. Maybe they know that they've won. And I'm just here as decoration. I'm happy to be decoration with a steak. All good. And then they said that we won and Garth Nix gave us the award and I was...
So had you written this prepared?
No. And you know, the hardest thing with the anthology is to actually, when you're on the spot, remember everyone contributors' names. So I literally had my fingers out going through, I've got 9 people I've got to thank in the anthology. Who was in it? Will, Amy, Ellie, Melissa. I was like, oh, give me a second. No, but it was really great and it was a huge honour. And I couldn't be prouder that I got to go up there and represent the contributor team. Because we really are a family. Like, I've toured this book pretty much all over Australia with different combinations of the authors at different times. You know, we've been at Sydney Writers Festival, Melbourne Writers Festival. It has been lovely to do this with them, with this group of people who are genuinely so fabulous. And I've genuinely made friends with all of them. And it was just really nice to get up there and say thank you. That was just...
That's a good high. It's a good segue into writers' festivals in general.
Why would you bring this up?
I know. So recently we had Melbourne Writers' Festival and you wrote an article for Kill Your Darlings that offered some critique of that festival. Yeah. But yours kind of stood out amid a lot of discussion that was happening as having a pretty unique perspective.
Yeah. For starters, I wouldn't have trusted my critique and point of view with anyone except Kill Your Darlings, because I do have that trust that has been building with them since 2012. And I've written some tricky articles with them and they have always helped to distill my ideas and get my message across. So I knew that they could do this in this case as well. Ellen, the editor, kind of came to me because I will say, I think that I was approached because I had previously tweeted in support of the Melbourne Writers Festival after certain articles came out and I said, that's wrong. And in particular, one article from The Guardian pinpointed one of our authors that I represent as agent, Carly Findlay, and they queried why she was at the festival in various events when she doesn't have a book out. And they were implying that she wasn't a writer. And I kind of came out and said, hey, she has been blogging, writing about diversity, writing about actually really bringing down big organizations and talking in a really wide way about diversity and inclusivity and disability since about 2009. And her articles have been reproduced on, if you want to say, legitimate websites, but that's beside the point. And I also said, hey, she got a bidding war for her memoir that's coming out in February next year. So to imply that she wasn't worthy was really annoying to me. And I was also tweeting, I loved the festival. I really did. I went along to Emily Nussbaum. I went along to Ronan Farrow. One of my favorite events was Joe and Limo, the radio host who got fired from Gold 104.3. I went along to a talk of theirs about how we survived, and I loved that. I loved the festival. Mm. But the big thing for me, and I've been critiquing young adult literature and books for a while now, and the thing is, for me, I wouldn't share my opinions and my critiques and criticisms if I didn't love something. Because the assumption is, if you love it enough, you think that you can improve it. You think that it needs, you think that you can help it along. And if I just didn't care, I wouldn't say anything. But Melbourne Writers Festival is one of those things that I love. I had previously loved what they were doing to build a young adult and teen audience. So I wrote about that. What I saw as a blind spot in the festival was a lack of weekend general programming for teenagers, where they had previously done amazing things like Tarvi Gevinson and Angie Thomas being a keynote. They had previously done wonderful things on the weekend for teens who maybe weren't getting to the festival via schools program. They were doing wonderful things to build future audience, which is an investment in the future. And I don't know, I can't speak as to whether or not the Melbourne Writers Festival gets money out of those events. I don't think that's the reason that you do it. I think you do it as an investment in the future so that this whole festival gig keeps going. Because at one point, whether the literati like it or not, and if you go to any festival event, there is a definite imbalance to older audiences. At one point, that balance is going to shift. And teenagers today are festival attendees of tomorrow. And I just wanted to put out this critique saying you have to remember them. You have to court them right now. because I think I had a line in there that said, you know, we do not walk fully formed into our first festival event the second that we hit 35 and discover Radio National, you know. It's something that you have to, it takes time to build that audience, and it takes trust to actually keep giving them great programming that keeps asking them to come in. That's what you're asking them to do. You're asking them to come in, speak to us, talk to us. And if you don't do that, even if you drop the ball for 1 year, that can set you back a couple of years, you know, because you build a trust with them. And with teens especially, they age out, or, you know, you just have to be really conscious of them.
Is it ever hard to offer an opinion? Do you hesitate?
Yes. Australia is so small, and our publishing industry is so small. And I always give the example of when the Saturday paper first launched, they made it very clear that they were going to have anonymous book reviewers. And the reason being, they said, was because the review culture of literature in this country had become so friends writing about friends for friends. It had just become, I'm pretty sure that the Saturday paper didn't use this term, but I would call it a bit of a circle jerk, where it's just echo chambers upon echo chambers. So they said they wanted to do anonymous book reviews because it had gotten to the point when nobody could actually share their honest opinion for fear of hurting someone that they are very close to in some way in this industry. And that's still very, very true. We are so small in this industry. We really, truly are. And things like festival directors can be around for 7 odd years. So, you know, if I've gotten onto the bad side of Melbourne Writers Festival, I may well be cast out for 7 years until the next director comes along. Who knows? Who knows? There are consequences to sharing your opinions in this country because we are so small, and because we are not an industry that often gets reinvigorated with fresh blood, which is something else I also said. One of the reasons I found it so hard, having graduated from RMIT, to get into the publishing industry, and I had to do it by way of a paid internship, was because nobody is in publishing in this country for the money. They are in it for the love of it. And for that reason, people do not move out of the industry until they die, pretty much. So there's not much wriggle room for new people to come up. And you see it. It's things like the Emerging Writers Festival has, for instance, a really close link with Sydney and Melbourne Writers Festival. People who start out in Emerging will eventually graduate to those festivals. And it's great that the Emerging Writers Festival, especially in recent years, has had a lot of fresh blood and fresh talent coming in. And also, like me, somebody who graduated from Kill Your Darlings in 2012 to now being a literary agent, I'm part of this machine as well. Much as when I was a blogger, I felt outside of it, I'm now in it as well, and I'm part of that machine. I'm part of that old guard, pretty much, who's sticking around and is probably not letting someone new come up and come in. So for that reason, we are so small and we remain so self-contained, and we're all after the same small slice of pie. I also kind of think in terms of so many of us sit on panels and judging boards choosing literary prizes, and I've done that this year as well. I was on the judging panel for the Sisters in Crime Book Awards. But the Australia Council also pulls on the community to choose who gets funding, for instance. You know, we are kind of eating ourselves in these different realms, and it has ramifications. So it is really tricky to have critique and criticism when you're that in that closer quarters. And I've been biting my tongue a lot since 2016 when I became a literary agent, because I am very wary and conscious that it's one thing if there are ramifications on me as a person. But now that I'm with Jacinta and I represent authors, I don't want blowback on them for something that I've said. And, you know, the nature of the beast is, because I work in youth literature, that's probably where my critique and criticism is mostly honed into. But I can't pull up those same organisations the way I could have once upon a time when I was just starting out as a fresh-faced blogger, as an outsider. Because, like I said, now I'm in it as well. So I'm very aware that there are ramifications. And it is because we are so small. Which is a blessing and a curse, but in this case, it's a curse.
One final question, Danielle. What advice would you give to someone who is trying to make it as an author?
Oh, gosh.
Or a writer, or just to get in the industry in general, given you wear so many hats?
I would say don't shortchange yourself when it comes to your hobbies. You have transferable skill sets, even if it's tweeting. Even if you're somebody who is just an absolute gun ace on Twitter, that's a transferable skill set. That's social media managing skills, okay? For me, it was taking my book blogging. That was just for me. I called it my solo book club. But somebody read that and said, hey, here's a bigger platform. I took my transferable skill set of writing about books, and in particular, the intersection of feminism YA pop culture and the publishing industry. And I transferred that skill set of what I was already reading and loving and thinking about and writing about, and I just put it onto a different platform. So yeah, don't shortchange yourself. You are the things that you love can be the things that carry you into new industries.
That is great advice. Danielle Binks, thanks for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
To find out more about Danielle Binks, head to the show notes for this episode on thefirsttimepodcast.com. And don't forget to rate and review us if you're enjoying the podcast. That helps us get in more ears. Thanks.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, and RMIT School of Media and Communication.